Thank you, Jake, for coming on the podcast today. Appreciate you taking the time. You're a 19-year-old Thiel Fellow and founder, currently working on Pilgrim Labs. We connected on Twitter. You were working on a sleep product at the time, and now I think you're working on a little something different. But I think if you're not the youngest one to be on the podcast so far, you're definitely one of the youngest. And I think you've got a really bright future ahead of you. You've already built tons of projects throughout high school and even before that. So pretty cool to be able to connect and looking forward to the conversation. I think, before we dig deep into any one particular thing, for those who don't know you, it'd be great to get your origin story from sort of as early as you're willing to start to where you are today and talk about some of the decisions you made along the way.
So, I grew up in Toronto, Canada. My mom was Israeli and my dad was Canadian. And, I was raised alongside a few other siblings, and they're all older than me. So I don't know if you have any siblings. I'm sure some people in the audience do, but there really wasn't any like peace or quiet in the house growing up. It was just pure chaos. And, from a pretty young age, like I could engage in the chaos, but sometimes I would kind of just retreat like into my own brain. And, growing up, that at least, in my earlier years, that was like really only my real refuge. But when I was about like 6 years old, my dad, he had a really good idea of the trajectory of personal computing and, the role it would play in my life. And he thought it would be, a good idea to buy me a MacBook. So, I got my first computer when I was about six. And, being a 6 year old with a computer, there really isn't a clear or first thing to do. It kind of just seemed like an endless void. So, I just like downloaded Steam and played a bit of RuneScape. And that kind of like introduced me, I guess, into, gaming, which is still, a big part of my life today. But over the years after, being first introduced to the MacBook, I think that really just opened up this portal to, just new and emerging technology. So when I was about 9 years old, I convinced my dad to buy me the iPod Nano. It was like that square iPod. And I remember like taking like tape and like an old watch bracelet and like slapping the iPod Nano onto my wrist so I could like change my music while I was on the go. And really, that was like my first experience ever with like a wearable computing device. I grew up being a big sci-fi reader, so I was obsessed with Asimov, and my favorite show to this date is Futurama. So wrist-worn communication devices and computers were something that to me were pure fantasy, like science fiction. And then seeing it abstract into reality with that initial iPod Nano kind of opened up another door for me to explore. And over the years, I tried to really get a hold of any wearable devices I could. But of course, the challenge was money. So my parents divorced when I believe I was about 8 or 9 years old. It would have been like 2011 or 12. And, effectively, after that point, finances, became, more of a concern in terms of, me being able to buy these technologies. So in 2012, this would have been, in the earlier days of Minecraft. And I'm not, I know Minecraft is like a massive franchise today, but this is like version 1.1 or 1.25. This was when, the kids in my grade, like I had to provide technical support to them because they didn't really understand, how to like download Minecraft or Skype. I got introduced to Minecraft by my brother and decided I was going to create like this class Minecraft server, so I could start paying for these wearables that I wanted to test. And effectively, I started the server, and it was a really bad business model. People used to come up to me and would just like ask for like a specific rank, like if there would be like a rook or a knight or a bishop, whatever. And I would just give them different prices. So, at some points, I was collecting like $15 to like $30 for a rank. And it was initially very profitable. The operation went very well. And then I later learned that these kids, I guess I didn't really think about it, but these kids were, 9, 10 year olds, they really didn't have $50 to spend on a rank. So they would go home to their parents and tell them that it was money for lunch or for like a school trip. So once the parents got wind that it wasn't, for those purposes, I was forced, to give the money back. But I was fortunate that I was able to get some wearables before that happened. And really the obsession with these different wearable devices. You know, I was fortunate to get the Apple Watch Series 0 and then play around with Garmins and Fitbits and a few Pebbles. Was I would buy them and I would try them out for like the first month, and then I would tear them, like completely tear them apart, and I had no clue what I was doing. You know, I was using like the back end of like a metal ruler and like a hair dryer to like get rid of the adhesive. But you know, I kind of just kept collecting the circuit boards because I was just so fascinated how, you know, this individual component, like a green LED and a photodiode, would be able to monitor heart rate. Like that just seemed like such an abstract concept to me. And, you know, that kind of led into this whole, you know, obsession around wearable computing from a very young age. And in 2014, there was this Kickstarter campaign for a device called Muse. It is from a company in Toronto called Interaxon. And it, to me, you know, to my knowledge, at the time, was the first consumer-oriented brain-computer interface. So it was a device that would monitor your brain activity and score a meditation session. And I was like 11. So meditation wasn't a very salient or very immediate concern for me. But what was is the developer SDK that Muse had. So basically using the Muse device, you'd be able to control, you know, web apps using, you know, specific signals that you train it on, like eye blinks. So, you know, I convinced my dad for Christmas to participate in the Kickstarter campaign. And I got the Muse device and started building out applications like that, you know, like controlling the Dino game on Chrome, like if you go offline, using your eyes. And, you know, Muse at the time, you know, was using, I believe, conductive ink as the electrodes. So, you know, the signal quality was really poor, but I was able to build out like a few web apps around it. And that progressively led into some of the later work that I did with the Neurosity Crown. So in like 2018 or 19, I believe, you know, I reached out to this company called Neurosity, which is, you know, a startup that was developing or is developing, you know, a non-pharmacological or a non-drug-based intervention for clinical for ADHD. And effectively, you know, I reached out to the founder, and their devices were like $1,100. And this would have been in like grade 10 or 11. And I was broke. I couldn't afford, you know, an $1,100 brain computer interface. So I reached out to the founder, initially tried out their emulator, and then kind of told him about some of the applications I wanted to build. And, you know, I'm incredibly grateful because he actually sent me like two of their crowns, like two of their devices for free. And I started building out like advanced human machine teaming applications. So, you know, controlling my Spotify and controlling my Nanoleaf using my brain. And really, you know, about halfway through my time kind of playing around with the crown, you know, I participated in this hackathon where we were kind of coming up with ideas for, you know, novel brain computer interfaces. And in that hackathon, you know, on, you know, very primitive level, one of them we had was building, you know, a neuromodulation device for treating clinical insomnia. And, you know, it seemed like a interesting concern, but something that didn't really affect me. But that kind of changed a few months later when I found out that, you know, both my parents have been, you know, longtime users of sleeping pills, and they tend to, you know, in the past have used sleeping pills in a more excessive manner than what would be recommended. And that has led to, you know, when I was growing up, certain events to occur that I never really had an explanation for until, you know, I found out that it was because of sleeping pills. So, you know, with that, you know, personal motivation and, you know, with the knowledge of how these technologies fundamentally worked, I kind of just challenged and said, like, is it possible to build out, you know, a non-pharmacological intervention for treating clinical insomnia? And, you know, spent a few months just conducting really as much research as I could. I really had to hold myself back. You know, I think when you're, you know, when you're young, you intuitively want to like jump right into it, but I wanted to make sure I had, you know, the proper understanding of the existing literature before, you know, I decided to try and pursue this one approach. And, you know, read likely around 200 or 300 research papers at the time. And now that number is like 2000, but started this company called New Sleep. That was basically in my grade 12 year. And, you know, I signed my first angel check on my birthday on June 6th. It was from Corey Levy, and then we proceeded to raise like another 150,000. It ended up being around 275,000 for our initial round. And we had participation from, you know, the founder of Casper, it's like the mattress company, Ben Pasternak, like the founder of Simulate, Corey Levy, Purina Holdings. So the LPs were like the founder of Shutterstock and Misfits Market. So really cool people. And we were developing, and we kind of still are developing, a sleeping mask that directly induces and improves sleep to treat clinical insomnia. So it's intended to act as an alternative intervention. It's also entirely closed loop, so it's personalized to the individual. And, you know, in real time, we're monitoring sleep stages, neural activity, heart rate, you know, basically the nine yards of vitals to optimize, you know, treatment in real time to each individual patient. And effectively, you know, I was working on that for really the first 8 months. And then back in January, you know, I was in Miami at Miami Hack Week, and I was speaking with an individual who, you know, has previously worked with the CIA through defense contracting and other opportunities. And I told him a little bit about what we were working on. And he recommended, he goes like, look, I think you should speak to the DOD and the Defense Innovation Unit, or the DIU. And to me, defense, you know, I had this idea that maybe defense could be a viable approach down the road, but definitely not something that, you know, we would be pursuing immediately. But as I looked deeper down the rabbit hole of defense, I recognized that it was far more feasible for us to become a defense company than to become a consumer-oriented company. And that was just for a few reasons. First of all, you know, the FDA is completely overwhelmed right now, which has led to, you know, an under-regulation of the industry. And that has led to, you know, a lot of these devices that aren't being properly tested for safety and efficacy being released on Kickstarter and trying to, you know, circumvent the FDA, which makes it really challenging because it creates a lot of noise that would be tricky for us to kind of get through in terms of penetration with, you know, the signal. So, you know, having that one customer in who would likely be, you know, the DOD would kind of help us avoid all of that other noise. A big proponent to that as well is the fact that private investors generally dislike backing companies that want to work with the FDA. You know, they see the FDA as really a big, mean, you know, monster. And to me, it's much more of a necessary evil. You know, pursuing a relationship with the FDA, you know, from the beginning of building NuSleep, to me was really the steps to ensure that there was longevity in the company. Because like I said, you know, the FDA is overwhelmed. They don't have enough resources to send out enforcement letters to, you know, these small startups, but they have enough to send it out to, you know, those that hit 100 million in valuation, because it allows them to make a proper return. And then maybe on, you know, a slightly more selfish note, I recognize that some of the technologies that I was, you know, keen to work on and develop would likely be outside of, you know, the immediate consumer interest. So, you know, to me, working with the DOD kind of opened up this new door and this new route. And, you know, growing up as well, you know, reading a lot of sci-fi, you know, reading a lot of, you know, cyber and biopunk. Effectively, you know, I hit this point as well where I recognize that if you're looking at, you know, how these cyberpunks are portrayed, and this is slightly abstract, but, you know, it tends to be like this Orwellian society that's controlled by a single corporate entity that favors the rich. And, you know, inherently by kind of changing the approach and working closely with the government from the beginning, ideally would, you know, keep us away from this dystopian future and really enable this technology to eventually hit mass adoption without being, you know, distorted or without being alienated from, you know, the general market. So, you know, with that, basically defense was on my brain. I wanted to evaluate the budgets and make sure that this would be a viable business, and basically look through fiscal year 24, the entire DOD budget for RDT&E, which is research development, test and evaluation. And there was about $6.37 billion allocated and directly salient to the technology that we were working on. So, you know, I immediately recognized that there was, you know, a defined, you know, market size for our specific technology. You know, incentives for us to work alongside the DOD, not only for, you know, developing experimental and novel technologies, but also for our relationship with the FDA. And then additionally, you know, there was, you know, this final factor that happened when I came, you know, back home to Toronto and had a conversation with a family member who served in the IDF about some of the technology that we were developing. And, you know, it was clear that, you know, once I expressed that we're kind of making this transition over to defense, you know, he suffered from a fatigue-related injury, that this was the right move for us and something that I personally felt would really be the next step for the US. And about 3 or 4 months back, we made the transition to Pilgrim. We rebranded the company. I'm happy to talk about why we chose the name Pilgrim as well, but we rebranded and kind of shifted our vision. So we moved away from building, you know, this novel sleep aid to developing advanced biological interfaces that can restore and enhance warfighter capabilities. Our primary focus is really on the three critical dimensions of ground warfare, which include lethality, resilience, and readiness. And effectively, you know, we've been experimenting with a few interfaces, and, you know, developing out some novel technologies for the US government and a few allied governments as well.
Great. Well, I appreciate the story. It's super interesting. And obviously your passion and obsession with wearables and, the personal tie-in with sleep and everything like that is super evident. So it's no surprise, you know, what you're working on today. Could you talk a little bit before we get into Pilgrim about what New Sleep was actually going to do differently than like everything else on the market? We've obviously got, you know, everyone's got Aura rings and, the Whoop band and the Apple Watch and the 8 Sleep bed. And none of these are doing anything to you physically. Arguably, I guess the 8 Sleep bed is changing the temperature of your bed. So there's some sort of like physical component there. Everything else is just sort of like tracking and through measurement, you know, what gets measured gets managed. You can sort of improve your sleep or your habits, you know, with the Whoop or the Apple Watch or the Aura around general health as well. Some of the concepts that it sounds like you're working on more now with Pilgrim around readiness and things like that. But purely on sleep, like what's the current state of the market? And do you have confidence, despite the pivot, that the sort of lane that you were going down on the sleep wearables track is going to be a track that sort of succeeds in the near term?
It's a valid question. You know, with New Sleep, our goal was, like I said, to develop, you know, a non-pharmacological alternative. So something that would be as efficacious and potentially more safe than the existing drugs. So whether we're talking Z drugs or the benzodiazepine class, ideally the solution would be, you know, fitting for individuals who were suffering from clinical insomnia, primary or secondary, and could actually treat their disorder. Really, the approach with New Sleep, unlike, you know, many of the existing wearables, like I'm wearing a Whoop right now, you know, was the fact that New Sleep was intended to move beyond, you know, this supplementation and move to this world of enhancement or amplification. And in terms of supplementation, I'm not referring to like melatonin or GABA. I'm more so referring to the supplementation of data. So, you know, these wearable devices as of today are incredible resources because they provide us with insight and, you know, tracking that enables us to actually potentially optimize, you know, our sleep and our schedules. The concern is that the data isn't really that actionable, and it also isn't implemented in real time. So treatment tends to, you know, be somewhat non-existent with the existing wearable solutions. So the intention with New Sleep was to kind of capture both of those domains. So it would be able to monitor the body in real time, such as your current sleep stage, your heart rate, the oxygen saturation in your bloodstream, your skin temperature, and based off of those specific vitals, be able to actually adjust treatment in real time to, you know, put you into a state of sleep or potentially help you maintain that state of sleep. Specifically, what New Sleep was doing was using, you know, and still is, it's using electrical stimulation to influence the deep brain regions, the actual specific neurophysiological mechanisms that are involved with sleep induction. So it effectively puts the individual into a state of sleep faster. I can't talk much about the specific effects because that would be making a marketing claim, but it is intended to treat clinical insomnia, and the existing peer-reviewed evidence proved that it was more effective, around 3 to 9 times more effective than existing pharmacological approaches. So really the approach was trying to capture kind of both sides of that wearable market. I think 8 Sleep is a cool company. I think Matteo has done really well with building out the business. The challenge with building a company like 8 Sleep and even building New Sleep in the consumer-oriented space is that while wearable devices are becoming a prominent feature in modern society, they're still relatively obscure. You know, I know a lot of older individuals that suffer from really severe clinical insomnia and don't use any wearables to track their sleep, right? So getting them involved with these types of technologies, especially, you know, novel and experimental ones, is kind of a offshoot and potentially, you know, a challenging endeavor. And I think Matteo has nailed it because sleeping on a mattress is using their product. The challenge is that people aren't always sensitive to temperature changes. So some people might just naturally sleep hot, and then 8 Sleep just isn't as functional as it should be. So I think there really is implications and challenges on you know, really all the ends of the market, but sleep tech will likely be a massive market in the future. I think sleep is really one of those domains where, you know, you have very little control. You know, when you go to the gym and when you exercise, you can choose what weight you want to lift, but you don't really get to choose, you know, your sleep architecture or your sleep quality. You kind of just take a gamble, right? So there really is this this opportunity to develop out novel solutions, but I really think it's just going to take some time before it's ready for the consumer market.
Yeah, that all makes sense. I want to also go back to a bit in your story where you're talking about like when you were first, you know, getting involved with the, you know, you taped the Nano to your wrist, and then you started, you know, I think with the Muse, you said it was the meditation hardware, you started to sort of see how, you know, simple, you know, brain computer interface stuff might work, and started like messing with, you know, that category. And you're talking about like controlling. Can you just explain a little bit? Because most people aren't really accustomed to like, obviously people, like most people, I think even in and around tech, they kind of like, they know, you know, about Neuralink that Elon's building, and, you know, they're familiar with the general concept of like, okay, maybe at some point we can connect, you know, brains to computers and become super smart, or you know, whatever it might be. But they're not really familiar with like active things that are available today that are workable. And you were talking about like controlling games with your eyes or something like this. Can you explain like the edges that you've been to in playing around with these sorts of things?
Yeah, neurotech is definitely, you know, like I said, still relatively obscure for the consumer market. There is quite an array of devices that are readily accessible for, you know, just everyday individuals. And, you know, Muse is obviously one of the bigger companies that have established themselves. It's Muse or Interaxon at this point. And, you know, they have a few devices. Some of them are for sleep tracking, using like some additional auditory stim to try and help out with, you know, falling asleep, which isn't really any different than just putting like a speaker, you know, close to your ear. But point is, you know, Muse exists. And then you also will have, you know, other solutions. You'll have, you know, Neurosity, like I mentioned, you know, they're a great company. Which is basically uses what they call neuroadaptive audio. So it monitors your brain waves, like your brain activity, and tries to adjust the audio to help you obtain a state of focus. And then outside of that, you know, there really is just a lot of, you know, new companies that are emerging every single day. Frankly, the challenge is really keeping track of the ones that are in, you know, that are still operating and those that are now defunct. But, you know, there is really quite an array. I found, you know, generally that if you're looking for products that, you know, won't be, you know, regulated by the FDA, not because they shouldn't be, but because the companies don't want to work with the FDA. Good sources like Kickstarter, Indiegogo. There's a lot of new neural interfaces there. But just as a general point, and just, you know, a little bit of explanation for, you know, that wider population, Neuralink and what Elon is working on is a invasive solution. So it's what would be referred to as like a neural implant. It would be physically inserted into the brain and attaching like these electrodes, which are effectively, you can think of like mini wires to individual neurons. There kind of exists like a spectrum of invasiveness. You have things like EEG, which would be completely non-invasive, safe for everyday individuals to use without, you know, a medical professional, all the way up to things like Neuralink, which are heavily invasive, along with like deep brain stimulation, which is really the most invasive neural implant that we have today. But really anything that uses EEG, EEG or FNIRS, so functional near infrared spectrography. So basically monitoring the changes in hemoglobin concentration around the brain to determine oxygenation would also be non-invasive. If you're interested in solutions like that, Mendy is a good company as well. And then there's a lot of other existing companies in the space that are working on neuromodulation devices. So devices that can, you know, actually apply electrical stimulation to the brain and to, you know, the peripheral nervous system. I won't recommend any of those companies because that is a clinical intervention and they should be working with the FDA, and they're not. But if you're interested, I encourage you to explore them yourselves.
Right. So maybe we can now shift to Pilgrim and what you're working on now. I understand there's a lot of cool stuff. I'm not sure how much of it you can talk about or that you'd like to talk about at this point, but the theme is basically these advanced biological interfaces to restore and enhance warfighter capabilities. And that's like, that sounds great, but it's a bit abstract to understand what's actually the focus there. Is it something in the realm of like Aura and Whoop? Is it something that's much more like what we're talking about now, where there's some sort of brain computer interface going on, you know, non-invasive or invasive or whatever it might be? Can you just sort of like lay out the broad strokes to the extent that you can of what you guys are working on at Pilgrim? And actually, I'm curious the background on the name as well.
Yeah. So you know, I'll address the first point. But, you know, Pilgrim is really a evolution of New Sleep. It's fundamentally, you know, grounded in the same belief that wearables should move beyond just supplementing you with data and effectively use that data in real time to treat, you know, a biological inefficiency or disorder. So our approach with Pilgrim is would be not aligned with companies like Aura or Whoop in the sense that they're just tracking vitals and displaying data. Like I said, you know, we effectively are actively deploying that data in real time to treat that specific condition. So, you know, the primary targets, and I'm happy to talk about these that we've been focused on, has remained, you know, like I said, those three, you know, dimensions of warfare, which are lethality, resilience, or survivability, and readiness. On the readiness point, you know, we're still pushing the New Sleep device. There is, you know, immediate and demand and salient demand for the technology. You know, the reality is that these warfighters are sleeping in incredibly austere conditions, you know, on top of each other, under vehicles, in moving vehicles. You know, the quality of sleep and the norms around sleep within the DoD are incredibly poor. You know, it's expected to sleep like 5 to 6 hours per night. You know, roughly, I think 67% of the active military population inhibits the symptoms of clinical insomnia. And, you know, between, you know, the Iraq and Afghanistan war, you know, the Iraq war and the deployments to Afghanistan, there was like a 653% increase in reported clinical insomnia cases. So the treatment of insomnia is a, you know, an immediate need within the DoD, especially given the restricted use of some, you know, existing pharmacological aids, like benzodiazepines and Z-pills, given, you know, the effects they have on, you know, vigilant attention, hand-eye coordination. They really just aren't great solutions. And then on the other side, I'm happy to talk about this as well, but what we've been actively exploring is accelerated healing technologies. So effectively ways to accelerate the pace at which a wound closes. So kickstarting hemostasis, which is the blood clotting process, along with angiogenesis or the creation of new blood vessels, and then some addition of infection prevention to enable a wound to heal far faster than it would naturally. And, you know, some of the approaches that we've been evaluating have been able to deposit collagen, which is critical for wound closure at a rate of about like 3 times faster than natural. And effectively, you know, it's the difference between, you know, a 30-day recovery time and a 10-day recovery time for severe wounds. So there's really interesting applications, but really the goal is to really push the limits of what is possible in terms of biological interfaces and really, you know, enable humanity. And, you know, I'm trying to avoid using grandiose language, but really enable humanity to move to this, you know, new level of capabilities. And in regards to Pilgrim, like the naming, you know, there was quite frankly, a few reasons why we decided to move forward with that name. You know, first of all, I recognized pretty early on that this journey was going to be relatively long and arduous. And, you know, that can be comparable in some ways to a pilgrimage. But, you know, growing up, my favorite book was Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. And the primary character's name is Billy Pilgrim. And the story kind of, you know, depicts this. It's really a nod to Pilgrim's Progress, another novel by John Bunyan. But really, it depicts the story from like sin to salvation and innocence. And, you know, in another way, you know, the pilgrims, really the entire journey that they went on as Puritans were, you know, moving away from religious dogma at the Catholic Church to America in hopes of advancement and progression. And it really felt like that's where we are at right now with the DoD. It's just defense primes. And now we have startups that are largely focused on autonomous systems. So this really opened, you know, this new window for us to advance, you know, how wars are fundamentally fought. And to me, you know, Pilgrim was a fitting name for that. And then, you know, on top of that, you know, Pilgrim, you know, the Pilgrims really played and still, you know, to me are a solid representation of the American ideals that make the country so great, freedom and liberty. And, you know, they have had, you know, a rough history. I think there is, you know, various depictions of the events that occurred. But I think regardless, you know, they had hope and they really wanted to push the narrative for what's possible for the United States. And that's really how I feel as well.
Interesting. Yeah, both on what you're doing with the company and the naming as well. It seems like you've just been extremely thoughtful and deliberate about really most of what you've done in, you know, this early chapter of life, and whether it's, you know, deciding what you want to work on or how to name that project. So it's really cool to see. A further question on Pilgrim. You guys have made a conscious decision to focus on warfighters and their capabilities as opposed to something like autonomous weapons or weapon development and something like that. Can you describe a little bit what went into that decision-making process, why you've gone in the direction that you have?
Yeah, so, you know, fundamentally, this belief around, you know, autonomous weapon systems, or really the use of machines in warfare, you know, it isn't really new. It's been really around since the 40s, and, you know, it's kind of spurred up through different points in history. You know, a good example of this is back in August 6, 1944, so like 2 months after D-Day, or the invasion of Normandy. You know, effectively, it became such a fallacy where we overestimated the capabilities of machines, specifically armored systems at that time, where, you know, on that day, so when, you know, likely hundreds of individuals were being killed, hundreds of Allied forces were being killed in World War II, you know, we had a single rifleman in reserves. So like a single human to replace, you know, the hundreds that were dying. And, you know, alongside, you know, this belief has been the fact that wars, you know, are fundamentally fought by humans when they come face to face. And that's, you know, not just my sentiment, but one that was, you know, shared throughout history, from, you know, great military historians like S.L.A. Marshall, all the way up now to more contemporary thinkers, you know, like Mark Milley, who just kind of stepped down as the former Joint Chief of Staff, the director, chairman rather. But point is, you know, our approach is effectively trying to really manipulate and improve warfighter capabilities. To me, really, the fundamental force here is that the crux of conflict resolution is in ground warfare. And really, this is a sentiment that's, you know, further evidenced by, you know, just the Army's modernization strategies. So if you're looking at where the Army is trying to go in the next 10 years, like 2030 and beyond, you know, they're moving away from brigade combat teams, which are composed of, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 units, or soldiers, to about, you know, divisions, which are 10 to 15,000 troops. And, you know, this transition isn't purely just about the numbers. It's really the recognition, like I said, that, you know, aerial and naval autonomous systems, so things that are being developed by great companies like Anduril and Saronic, while these are, you know, great solutions, they simply complement ground warfare. Like, they kind of act as this external factor that augments, you know, operational awareness, or positioning, but don't actually affect how wars are, you know, properly conducted or how they're resolved. And to me, you know, what's necessary is, you know, addressing the largest vulnerability in our existing defense apparatus, which is the warfighters, especially given the fact that they are, you know, our most prized possession, as ground warfare tends to be, you know, the most critical aspect of how, like I said, wars are addressed. So for us at Pilgrim, really the next phase is developing out these technologies, these biological interfaces that would enable, you know, these warfighters to navigate modern conflicts, and then also, you know, command the wars of the future, you know, providing us with this overmatch over any adversarial, or over really any adversary in regards to, you know, physiological or neurobiological warfare as well. So really the long-term vision for the company, you know, like I said, is really bringing these technologies to warfighters, but eventually, you know, with time, when things become, you know, more accessible in terms of how fast we can manufacture them, and really the cost behind, you know, each individual interface, is bringing them back to the consumer market with mass adoption. So that's really the intention, and really why, you know, warfighters are to me, you know, the next step. And then, you know, just as a final point, you know, one of the movies I watched growing up, and it's crazy that most people haven't seen it, is 2001: Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke. And I won't spoil the movie, but, you know, really it's this journey, and it's a story about, you know, the evolution of humanity. And it includes, you know, this progression through the use of, you know, artificial general intelligence, and really how humanity overcomes it to really transform into this next evolution of capabilities, and what they referred to as like a star boy. And to me, you know, there was this incident in grade 7 where, you know, I went to like a science fair, and I spoke to a panel of judges and asked, you know, about the looming AI singularity event where, you know, general intelligence or artificial intelligence would supersede, you know, human intelligence, and kind of create like this existential threat that would, potentially kill humanity. And, he basically responded with the fact that, he believed that the human brain will persevere. And, we are inherently a scrappy, race of organisms that will try and do everything we can to, overcome, our limitations. And I think that really played into some of the early philosophy of what we've been building at Pilgrim, is like, really, like, how do we kind of create or enable humanity to move beyond and ensure that we can maintain our superiority with some of the threats that are created with the rise of AGI. And to me, I really do hope that the future kind of resonates and falls in line with what Arthur C. Clarke imagined, where, we recognize that AGI, had the significance and could eventually provide, this new world of capabilities. But the reality is that, without sounding speciesist, as a human race, that we need to overcome that. And we need to kind of move to this new world of what we are inherently capable of. And to do that, that starts with, not only upgrading the environment around, that's like what Anduril and Saronic or even Apple does for the consumer population, but starting to inherently, and move to upgrade ourselves. And, I think that is, a big proponent to the long-term vision at Pilgrim.
Switching gears a little bit, you wrote a piece on a Medium, I think, blog in 2021 on sort of the issues with the current sort of formal education system, traditional education system, grade school, high school, college, and all that. And you referenced some resources for people who might be interested in like dropping out or pursuing another system, Thiel Fellowship, 1517 Fund. I've had both the founders, Michael and Danielle from 1517 on the podcast before. I recommend people go listen to those episodes if they're at all interested. But you're now a Thiel Fellow yourself. 2 years later, after writing that piece, at some point along, in between there, you applied and, they chose you. So to the extent that you can share, would love to sort of hear that story, your sort of parallel path to the traditional education system and, how's it going with the fellowship so far?
Yeah, I think the fellowship took a really big bet, and, I'm very grateful. Some of the advisors I had who have been involved with the fellowship in the past told me that, I likely wouldn't have gotten it just based off of what their selection criteria was. But, coming out of high school, my grade 11, one of my final years, I was entirely remote. I was in this condition and, I wasn't able really to see anyone because, I had, individuals at home who had, or, if they got sick, it would have been a serious concern. And it was very isolating. And, during that time, I'm fortunate, just like earlier on in my childhood, that I could really resort to technology. Technology from a young age really was like this younger brother. It would be kind of like this supporting factor that could kind of like always cheer you up a little bit when things got rough. And, during that time, like that was 2020, 2021, I really just saw how far I could go. I think most people associate, these or many professions in life, like with this like invisible wall, like I have to go to obtain my bachelor's degree. I have to go to, obtain a master's or a graduate. And that's not entirely true. I think there obviously are some professions that are driven by, experience and empirical evidence, but generally I found that, in most cases I've seen, young individuals up until that point, working on some of the most batshit crazy ideas. And, clearly their lack of a bachelor's degree wasn't stopping them from doing that. So really my process with the fellowship, I wanted to become a fellow from, the moment I first learned about it. To me, I really saw it as like, a path to like salvation, especially given that, both my parents wanted me to go to university. And, I first applied when I was in grade 9. And continuously apply for a few years on and off. And then basically, after I started New Sleep, I applied again and was put into consideration. There's a few interviews that happen. And I got word that I was a fellow early this year, I believe, early this year. And again, they took a big bet. I was very shocked. But, the people I've been able to meet, like the other fellows, have just continued to blow my mind. And the sheer knowledge that you see at such a young age, it's very inspiring. And it really, to me, provides like this route for those that are inquisitive and curious and, you know, recognize that they can address and they can start working towards these real and hard problems from a young age. It provides them with an alternative path. Actually, recently, Brett Adcock, he posted something on Twitter that I retweeted about, you know, if you're young and you're interested in hardware, there really shouldn't be any factor stopping you from like teaching yourself, you know, PCB design or the fundamentals of electrical engineering. And the unfortunate aspect is that in society today, that's kind of, you know, there's a lot more push than pull in that sense, that, you know, a lot of kids I knew and I grew up with, like, used to tell me, like, my friends used to tell me, like, why can't you just do like normal teenage stuff? And not like my parents, but like my friends. So, you know, I think for those, like I said, that are curious and, you know, are deeply interested and passionate about addressing, you know, a real goal. And on top of that, I would argue that, you know, becoming a TEAL fellow, at least the TEAL fellows I'm close with, the commonality is, you know, this deep sense of self-awareness. I see far too often that a lot of the younger founders are potentially, you know, not as aware as they should be, you know, pursuing a startup or a business model that just doesn't really make a lot of sense. And obviously that comes with experience, but it also just comes through conversations, just like being or allowing people to be critical of your approach, and really just iterating and not falling in love with your first product, because that really just is the only path to progress and to evolve. So yeah, I mean, I'd highly recommend, you know, applying for the TEAL fellowship. I'd highly also recommend, if you're young and you're looking for a bit of financing to work on a project, look into 1517's Medici grant. I'm sure, you know, you guys talked about that on the podcast as well. It's just like, I believe if they're still offering it, it's $1,000. It's a great source of initial funding that I wish I had when, you know, I was initially working with wearables. And, you know, I think the truth is that you really just have to be, from a young age, you're not going to have a lot of capital behind you. You know, some kids are able to raise, you know, $20, $30 million. I would highly, highly recommend that if you are young and you want to build, you know, a hardware company, or you want to build something in deep tech, that you try and raise less than you actually need, because it will force you to teach yourself a lot. You know, the amount of information that, you know, I've been privy to in the past year and a half has, you know, completely altered, you know, how I see the world. So, you know, I would say try and raise less than you think you need, and really just put more responsibility on yourself, because it will drive you to become, you know, or drive you to develop a harder, you know, realistically, you know, a stronger work ethic, but it also, you know, help you develop out, you know, knowledge around, you know, these very obscure but relevant topics to whatever you're building, such as, you know, my work with the FDA and the some of the early work with the Department of Defense.
Yeah, I think one thing that's always interesting when you hear from people who are taking a very different path, or maybe sort of on a very accelerated path, like you're here, you're working on a company, you've worked on many other projects before. This clearly isn't like your first rodeo, just by the way that you're speaking and stuff, even if it is maybe your first formal entity that you're raising capital for, or whatever it might be. And it's interesting to hear like what people like that, you know, you can sort of get the broad strokes of how they're living very differently, but it's interesting actually to just like go into the day to day, or like the hour to hour, week to week, like the smaller scale things that they're doing differently that, you know, sort of like sum up to this larger way of living in a very different way. So I'm curious if you have any, you know, you talked about like self-awareness and things like this, any habits or routines or just things that you do on like a micro scale, day in and day out, week in and week out, that are very different from most people, that you think could have sort of an impact on why you've been able to, you know, why the TEAL Fellowship, for example, recognized something in you. One thing that I could even just pull out of your story is you didn't get into the TEAL Fellowship on your first try. It sounds like you applied at least, I don't know, 3 or 4 times. So there's like clearly persistence there, that I don't know what percentage of people who get rejected from TEAL Fellow apply a second time, let alone a third and a fourth. So that's like a characteristic, you know, one might take for granted. I particularly think persistence is, as far as I can tell, probably the single, you know, most correlated trait to extreme success, at least in business and, you know, technology and stuff like that. So anyway, long, I gave you a little bit of time maybe to think about it, but curious sort of daily habits, routines, weekly stuff that sets you apart.
Just addressing your final point there, you know, like a maxim that I keep very close to, like, whatever you want to call the soul. And something I've tried to question a lot in the past, but I haven't been able to break it yet, is that with enough time and with enough effort, like, really practically anything is possible. I think, you know, and Elon will make the comment, like, within the defined laws of physics, and I think that makes sense. But I also think that the laws of physics are just as we understand them right now, but potentially with enough time and with enough effort, we can redefine them. So, you know, the point is that, like you said, persistence is massive. In terms of general habits, I'm probably the wrong person to ask. You know, the reality is that to build a company like this with, you know, how much, you know, we're just raising a bit more right now, but how much we initially raised means that really the person doing all the work is you. And if you're not working, then nothing is being done. So, you know, I've kind of fluctuated because of, you know, my background. There has been, you know, times in my life where I've gone to kind of both extremes, where, you know, I have previously followed, like, Brian Johnson's blueprint. I've been about 3 times now. And I've also been on the other side of that, where I was getting 2 hours of sleep, eating McDonald's for every meal, you know, or whatever, like shawarma or whatever, you know, I could find, and just grinding and going what you could, some people would call, like, degen. So really, in terms of habits, I don't really have many. I would say waking up in the morning and taking a shower tends to be pretty helpful. But outside of that, look, like, if you want to build a company and it's challenging, like, you're trying to work on something that, you know, requires a lot of manpower and will require a lot of effort and time, and the financing isn't there, or it's not there yet, I don't recommend, you know, immediately choosing to raise more. I would recommend seeing how far you can kind of push it yourself. And really, that just means pushing yourself to your limits. So really, if it requires you to work 14 or 15 hour days, like, that's the necessity. And for some reason, that's an unpopular opinion. I don't really quite understand why or how it is, because if you want to build something that's generational, it's going to require, you know, a significant amount of effort. And in those earlier stages, when you need to prove not only to these investors or to your customers, but to yourself, that it's worthy of your time, then you really need to be putting everything you have to make the company work. So in terms of just how I live my lifestyle, you know, I don't think I'm that healthy. You know, I tend to get really bad sleep, like 4 or 5 hours a night, and effectively all my other time is spent working. You know, in terms of just how, like, my situation, you know, I'm from Toronto. I'm living in Toronto right now, and, you know, a lot of the kids I grew up in with, you know, in my high school years have all gone off to university. So there really isn't much of a social circle here, which is great to get work done, because it means that there really isn't much social interaction, besides just the people on our team. But really, I think that's what's necessary. You really have to be willing to sacrifice everything if you want to make it work. And if you're not, then, you know, I'd question if that's really what you want to work on, because, you know, the best thing I ever heard, and just a good nod to just a company I think that's developing something great, is Pipe Dream. So, like, Pipe Dream Labs, the founder is Garrett. And, you know, through just conversations with some of their investors, you know, he expressed, and these people expressed, that, you know, Garrett told them upfront, you know, we're working on this for the next 10 years. It doesn't really matter whether, you know, this fails, or, you know, we face this specific challenge. Like, we're going to work our ass off to make this work. And it doesn't matter whatever, you know, situations we face along the way. And that really needs to be the mentality when you're building your company. I think it's fine to be skeptical. It's fine to be skeptical of what you're building, but you should really never feel immediately skeptical in yourself. You should be able to evaluate and try and iterate on your mentality. But if you start thinking, like, I'm not the right person to build this type of company, that's probably a good indicator that you need to switch what you're working on.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, it's, you don't really need too many habits, and I didn't certainly intend to imply that you do. I think waking up and taking a shower and grinding every day is as much different from how most people live as anything else that you could be doing habit wise. So,
what I want to say, though, on top of that, is that, like, don't just say, like, I think the worst is when I'm talking to founders and they're like, you know, I've given up everything and I just work all day and I have no life. because intuitively, I just think like the fact that he's telling me this means that he's likely not doing it. He's just like trying to reaffirm himself or whatever themselves to me. The reality is like you'll meet a lot of people, especially in SF, who are LARPing, like they're fully role-playing, and they'll pretend that they work these crazy long hours. I recommend if you're young and you're building, you know, a company, like I said, that's, you know, in deep tech or hard tech or something that's just inherently tricky, go back home and live with your parents. I would really advise against living in SF. I think there is this really big demand for these founders to live in San Francisco, but the challenge is that the incentives and what you feel compelled to do in San Francisco is not right for what you need to be doing. You know, you kind of become incentivized through conversations to be pitching more and more people and going to these parties, and especially hacker houses, which are, you know, a preeminent part of, you know, the SF culture, are incredibly distracting, because it's either, you know, you deal with this hurdle that you're facing with your project, or I walk outside and I have a group of five guy friends that I love talking to, and we can go grab a crepe together, right? Like there's a clear difference in the dopamine, and your brain will tend to select, you know, the latter, just out of, you know, sheer imperative. But point is, you know, the reality is if you are really committed and dedicated, isolate and just work, and you don't need to reaffirm to other people that you're working those hours, just do it. And your execution will reflect how much you work. And in some parts, like we're still so early, so it's tricky for me to say this, but I think even in some of the early conversations I've had with, you know, other people, you know, it's clear that was the factor. Like in those conversations with the fellowship, the execution was what mattered, right? I didn't come to them and say, you know, I was, you know, working 40 hours, you know, working 18 hours a day. And, you know, that's what enabled me to do all of this. It was just clear that, you know, based off of, you know, my prior projects and how far I was able to get with them in terms of execution, that was the amount of effort that was required to get there. And that was what stood out as an indicator. So again, I think working in public or building in public is interesting. Depends on the company. But if you're building something hard and tricky, I would say build in silence for a bit. You can be public about what you're building, but don't like rely on external dopamine or telling other people how much you work, because that's just not going to work for you.
Yeah, definitely a big difference between, you know, talking the talk and walking the walk. And to your point, walking the walk when you're doing it is evident in the actual results, basically. It's not like you need to be tracked for your full days or anything like that. Wrapping up here, because I know we're coming up on time. What do you expect of yourself, of your team, for the next whatever period of time makes sense to sort of project along? And, you know, just before we wrap up, where can people go to sort of follow what you're doing? Or maybe there's no place right now if you're just building in silence for the next while.
I mean, if you want to follow along with, you know, what we're building, or even, you know, you're interested in my tweets, which are sometimes funny but typically tend not to be, you can go to my Twitter. It's at Jake R. Adler. Not really that active, but it's sometimes when I have little moments of you know, when something good happens, maybe sometimes I'll publish or be a little bit more active on Twitter. But outside of that, you know, it's really tricky. You know, obviously timelines are really tentative, and really the philosophy and, you know, the approach with working in defense is, you know, being very sanguine. So, you know, trying to be realistic and slightly pessimistic about the process. But, you know, I think in the coming months, we will be a lot more transparent about the efficacy of our devices. So you can expect to see that pretty soon, along with some of our contracts that we are actively working on right now. So there'll be a lot more of a public presence in the coming months, just because, you know, it's somewhat out of necessity to build up the reputation around the company and the products that we build. But as for me, you know, I will likely just be in Toronto building for the next little bit until, you know, we finalize this round, and then, you know, maybe build out a small office in San Francisco. So that's really what I see as the next steps for the company.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Jake. It's been great having you on, and your, you know, sort of hunger and drive is evident in the way that you speak about, you know, what you're doing and what you're building. So great talking with you, and looking forward to following along with you and with Pilgrim, and you know, seeing what the future holds, but very optimistic.
Yeah, thank you.